We're going to return to our evaluation of Paul's letter, his fundamental statement, his initial statement, his letter to the Galatians thus far. What Paul has said has been obnoxious, untrue, and of a very poor writing quality. Now he moves on and says, "For you heard of my behavior in some time and place, in the practice of Judaism, namely, that because throughout and accordingly, showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing the called out of God. And I was and am devastating her, continuing to annihilate her." Now, I want to share with you the grammar of the last verb, which was, "I was and am devastating her, continuing to annihilate her." Portheo autos. I was and am attacking and overthrowing her. I was and am undermining and ravaging her, continuing to destroy her. It's from perthro, which means to sack. In the imperfect tense, this is an ongoing action, because in the past, there was no indication when it might cease, if ever. It's written in the active voice. So Paul was and is personally engaged in ravaging and destroying. And in the indicative, these attacks are being presented as actually occurring. Now, it is a fool's folly in much of the so-called Christian New Testament to examine words closely. And that is because Yahusha, for example, and his disciples spoke Hebrew. Those they spoke to engaged in Hebrew discussions. But the words are rendered, translated already into Greek. And Hebrew is a very powerful language. It's the language of heaven. It's the language of revelation. It's Yahweh's language of witness. Very profound in its insight. So when you translate a language that was specifically designed by God to communicate important aspects of his nature and the relationship and the covenant that he is his offering into a language that is part and parcel of a philosophical religious idea that encapsulated Greek culture. I mean, you lose an enormous amount. Also, we have the problem of the letters that are the four books that are considered biographical, if you will, that only two of those four were eyewitnesses. The other two are hearsay. So if you're trying to piece together what Yahusha said and did, you got two hearsay accounts that were not there, weren't even close, weren't even in the country at the time that these events were taking place, and only know of what was said and done by interviewing someone who listened to someone who was told by someone that someone else that they knew said such and such. There is nothing in Mark and Luke, for example, that would be admissible in a trial. It's hearsay. Now, Matanyah was originally written in Hebrew. We have lots of verifications of that, but we have no actual copies. The Hebrew copies were destroyed by the Romans. So all we have of it are very late and inadequate Greek translations. And Yahochanan, since it was such a favorite book, is so corrupt in terms of what was added to it, what was taken away from it, that it isn't even remotely credible. So when you realize that those books were written in Hebrew, about Hebrew discussions, and have been very poorly maintained, it's a fool's folly to investigate the words closely. But that's not the case with Paul's letters. Paul spoke Greek. He wrote in Greek. This letter was originally penned in Greek. It's not being translated from Hebrew to Greek. It was written in Greek. And we have a, through Papyrus 46, a comprehensive codex of all of Paul's letters. And Papyrus 46 dates to the late 1st, early 2nd century, so some of it was transcribed within 25 to 50 years of the original autograph. So with Paul, it's fair game to consider the grammar associated with each word. And therefore, Paul is saying here that he was attacking and is attacking God's called out. That he was undermining and ravaging God's called out. And that he's continuing to do so. That's what he conveyed. That's what the tenses communicate. Now, that ought to turn your stomach. Now, the second part of this is not only is the damage that he is expressing ongoing, and this is aggressively surpassing any measure of restraint, pursuing, devastating, annihilating. This is murderous. This is savage. This is the kind of behavior that we're witnessing being perpetrated by Muslims in Iraq today. And Paul is admitting that he had done it and that he was currently doing it. And he was doing it to God's called out. That would be the children of the covenant. And as bad as that is, and that's about as bad as bad ever gets, folks. And this is the founder of the Christian religion. This is the author of half of the Christian New Testament. And he just admitted that he had and was continuing beyond any measure of restraint to aggressively and intensively devastate and to annihilate God's covenant children. And that's really bad. I mean, it ought to be sufficient in and of itself to strike half of the books of the Christian New Testament from the canon. It ought to be enough to reject everything that Paul had to say. It should be enough to eliminate Christianity as a credible religion. But that may not have even been the worst part of what he had to say. Because what Paul did in this statement is he endorsed, he underscored, he projected the great carnage that Christians would perpetrate against Jews for centuries. And don't think for a moment that Christianity wasn't born as the enemy of God's chosen people, God's land, and Yahweh's Torah. If you haven't read the first four books of the Last Days volume of Yada Yah, you may want to do so. There is a portion in there that chronicles the writings of Christianity's fathers, of the first to actually govern Christianity, of the sermons and the books of those who were the first Christians in Rome when Christianity materialized as the official Roman religion. It'll make your toes curl. Well, Paul is advocating that because what he's saying is he's such a weasel. What he's saying here is that this despicable behavior, this lack of restraint in devastating and annihilating and attacking and overthrowing and undermining and ravaging was a product of Judaism. That's what he said here. He said it was in the practice of Judaism that beyond any measure of restraint, I aggressively and intensely pursued the called out of God. And I was and am devastating and continuing to annihilate her. The weasel that he is, he's not even taking responsibility for his reprehensible behavior. This is very much like what he wrote subsequently to the Romans, where he blamed the fact that he was an uncontrolled sexual pervert on the Torah. Now he's blaming his murderous and destructive behavior on Judaism. It's a slime bag. He's a weasel. This is a horrible man. Now, just as Paul lied when he accused the Torah of making him a sexual pervert in the 7th chapter of Romans, let me awaken those of you who are still anti-Semitic. Judaism is not the enemy of anyone. Now, I despise the Jewish religion. Rabbinic Judaism for me is repulsive. God hates the Jewish religion. I'm not going to advocate for the Jewish religion. But as religions go, Judaism is about as passive as religions ever get. Judaism did not launch wholesale assaults against other religious beliefs. They incorporated other religious beliefs, the Greeks, the Romans, the Babylonians. Those that held them captive, they embraced many of their religious beliefs. They did exactly what God asked them not to do and incorporated the myths of the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, and the Romans into the practice of rabbinic Judaism. But they're about as passive as any religion ever conceived by man. This behavior is not the product of Judaism. It's the product of this man's twisted mind. So if you're a Christian, now that you know that Paul has lied again, now blaming the practice of Judaism for his devastating, attacking, undermining, ravaging, and annihilating behavior, which he says was out of control. Now that you know that, why are you going to continue to pretend that Paul spoke for God? He was attacking, by the way, the ecclesia. He says God's ecclesia. The ecclesia is from ek and kalo, to call out. Those who are called out are those who observe the mikre. Those are the meetings, invitations to be called out and to meet with God. The covenant is called out, set apart. So now that you know this, what are you going to do about it? Are you just going to put on your rose-colored glasses and look at the world as if you don't know? Are you going to pretend that it doesn't matter? Are you going to wish it away and say, you know, if this was really true, if that's really what he said, then, you know, Christianity wouldn't be so popular. What are you going to do about it? You going to continue to squander your soul and perhaps the souls of your children, your parents, those you love, on what you now know is a madman? Why? Because the madman's religion is popular, because the madman's religion is integrated into society? Are you going to respond because now you know the truth? Are you going to be rational? Do you care enough about your old soul to judge and condemn this man based upon his testimony. And we've just begun. It gets much worse. But, you know, really, when you're dealing with a man who claimed falsely to speak for God, once he makes a statement like this that says that he was practicing a religion that caused him to be murderous, one such statement is more than sufficient to reject all of his testimony. The fact that there are hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of reasons to reject Paul, including Yahweh's testimony about him, Yosha's testimony about him, the fact that his testimony is in conflict with everything that God said and cared about, all of that matters. But just one statement like this is more than enough to reject him. There's no way to resolve what he just said. And as I say, there are hundreds of more reasons to reject him. But each of them is just another nail in the coffin. I shared yesterday with the Nestle Allen's interlinear, the McReynolds interlinear, how it presented the same revolting pallid words. It says, you heard for the my behavior, then in the Judaism, that by excess I was pursuing the assembly of the God and was ravaging her. The King James Version helped fan the flames of anti-Semitism by combining Jews' religion and beyond measure I persecuted the Church of God. For ye have heard of my conversation in time past in the Jews' religion, how that beyond measure I persecuted the Church of God and wasted it. Now, by the way, there is no basis for conversation in Paul's letter. But worse than that, there is no basis for church. Church is not a translation of ecclesia. Church is based on the name of a pagan sun goddess. Church was the daughter of Helios. Church is not a transliteration, which would be replicating the sound of ecclesia. Church isn't a translation of ecclesia. Church is based upon the words for circle in the sense that the sun is seen as a circular disk, that sun god circular halos are put above the gods and goddesses, that gods and goddesses like this had shrines that were established in circles like Stonehenge to represent the sun, and that there's magic being conducted in a place called a circus, all of which are related words. No hint here called out. None. You've been bamboozled if you're a Christian. In this particular case, the British, Sir Francis Bacon, most likely the author of the King James Version, can't blame the Roman, which would be Jerome, the Catholic, for Christianity's deadly opposition to Judaism. The Vulgate's rendering was somewhat more accurate. Jerome's Latin translation reads, for you have heard of my former behavior within Judaism, that beyond measure I persecuted the Ecclesium Dei, the Ecclesium of God, and fought against her. But here again, while former is a superior rendering of pote than is conversion, it isn't accurate. It speaks of any place in time and of some place in time and of an undisclosed point in the past, present, or future, and is thereby by no means limited to a former time. And it's not a minor point because Paul specifically used the imperfect tense in association with Portheo to say that he was continuing to ravage and destroy those who have chosen to be with God. He never stopped attacking. Now, the New Living Translation turned back the clock even further by completely ignoring Porte, by rendering Ecclesia Church, which is not a translation, but instead a copy edit, and by failing to communicate the ongoing nature of the final imperfect verb. They said and published, "You know what I was like when I followed the Jewish religion, how I violently persecuted God's church. I did my best to destroy it." Now, God is a lot of things, but church is not among them. We have Jack, who's called in from Massachusetts, who's got a question for us. Hello, Jack.
Yes, hello. You know, I share your frustration sometimes with your experience with the Christian community, but I find one thing, that they're locked into a time warp, that they, you know, into at least the third century of Constantine, and they can't achieve, you know, escape philosophy to get out of it.
Yeah. I think there is a lot of that. You know, if you were to actually go back to the third century, you'd find that Constantine was a horrible man. You know, the claim that he saw a sign superimposed on the sun of a burning cross and heard the voice, "Under this sign you shall conquer," and therefore converted to Christianity as a result and fought a battle with Christian symbols, is untrue.
And that's where you go with. You start with is Constantine.
Yeah, but the whole thing is untrue. I mean, yeah, he didn't see a vision. He didn't hear a voice. The whole thing was made up by his publicist a decade later. There was no Christian symbols on the shield. None of it happened. And Constantine never in his life converted to Christianity. The entire battle that he was fighting was a civil war amongst men aspiring to be Roman emperor. And so it was fought strictly for his own personal greed. And on prevailing in the battle at his foe's stupidity, his foes just simply backed into the river heavily armored, he dug his foe out of the river, cut off his head, and paraded his head around Rome. I mean, this is a disgusting man. And he is largely responsible for elevating the fate of the Christian religion to political status within Rome. And those around him, the clerics that he promoted, their writings, you read what they had to say, and it as I said, make your toes curl. It's just revolting. And you look at his Council of Nicaea and the Nicene Creed, which is the God of victory, the God of victory in the Greek religion, Nike. And the whole purpose was to create a caricature of a Christian God that was modeled after Dionysus, that represented the totality of God, so they could do away with the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And
I want to ask you about
beginnings. It's just revolting.
Dante's Inferno. Do you think he was onto something when he spoke about the lower levels of hell for the cardinals and bishops?
Well, no, I don't. First of all, I think that hell, which is that's the Greek term, and Yosha never spoke Greek, and it is. It's based on the Greek word Hades, and it's a Greek religious concept of an underworld. So there really is no hell in that sense. There is a Sheol, and Sheol is described as an eternal prison, as a pit, if you will, where nothing escapes. And so it is the place that is separated from Yahweh. It is Well, there is no direct correlation to this. When you read what is said about it, which is that it is the absence of Yahweh who is light, it is eternal separation, which nothing escapes, a place where souls, which are eternal, are imprisoned. It strikes me a lot as a black hole. And so, no, I don't think there are various levels of the place. I just think that the place is a prison for souls that have leagued with Satan, for Satan, for his, for the fallen Moloch that leagued with Satan. And it's going to be a very political, very religious place. And,
I just wondered if he was trying to say something, that's all.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about Dante's, I mean, I know of his Dante's Inferno, but I don't know enough about Dante's personal insights. The truth is, Jack, that I don't value human perceptions unless I have evidence to know for certain that those humans were inspired by Yahweh. So, for example, I care about what Moshe said in, as it's recorded in Devarim, Deuteronomy. I care about what David had to say as it's recorded in the Psalms.
I'm a Roman Catholic. I didn't.
I'm sorry.
Thank you for helping deprogram me a little.
Yeah. I'm glad. I'm glad that you have come out of Roman Catholicism, because while all of Christianity is rotten to the core, its birth is Roman Catholicism. You know, it began with Constantine, and Roman Catholics have never left that period of time.
They wish to remain in their comfort zones, and it's hard to change them.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, as I drive by on my way to lunch almost every day now, a Roman Catholic church, and you just shake your head and say, how in a world where information is so freely available are there any Roman Catholics? Why would you take your children to a Roman Catholic church? Why would you be married in a Roman Catholic church? Why would you care what the priest has to say in a Roman Catholic church? Here's a church that has specifically stated that Yahweh's name is never to be used in any of its services. Here's a church where they claim that a despicable man is infallible. Here's a church that has embraced every pagan tradition of every culture that they have assimilated, that promotes Christmas and Easter and Sunday worship, and All Hallows Eve, Halloween. There's almost nothing that is part of Roman Catholicism that is godly, and almost every aspect of it is an abomination to him.
You know, I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
We're kind of in DEFCON 1.
Yeah.
If you mind reviewing 17 and 18, because I think Isaiah is probably the best intelligence analyst there is around.
Yeah, you know, Jack, as I realized, and we did a whole series of programs on Isaiah 17 and 18, but because of the way the world is, as you're calling it right now, DEFCON 1, and the best intelligence of where the world currently is Isaiah 17 and 18. It speaks of the United States. It speaks of what's happening in Syria. It speaks of Islam. It speaks of the future of Israel. It speaks of the upcoming harvest of Teruah, and how many is going to be taken and from where they're going to be taken. It speaks of the belligerence and the militarism of America making the situation around the world so much worse. It is so pertinent that you're right. I mean, we should review it again and again. I moved from there to questioning Paul because there are 2 to 3 billion people today that unlike you, have not thought their way away from Christianity. And so I figured maybe we ought to go to questioning Paul to help them reason their way away from this obviously false religion. But
Yahshua said the pathway is very narrow and very few enter.
Yeah, it's true. And he's right.
If you can get a few people to come.
Yeah. What he etched in stone is that he said that fathers would corrupt their own children to the third and fourth generation, but that there would be thousands who would benefit from his mercy by observing the terms and conditions of the covenant. And thousands amongst billions, Jack is one in a million.
Right. Well, you have a good day now, huh?
Oh, well, thank you. And I've got to congratulate you on not only being able to think your way out of Roman Catholicism.
I have a long, long way to go, and I regard myself as a special needs student when it comes to the scriptures.
But, you know, you've done it in which would be considered the heartland of Roman Catholicism in America. I mean, Massachusetts is Massachusetts, and I would say the area around Cincinnati of Ohio, are the two places where the presence of Roman Catholicism is just stifling. And
well,
so
the pedophilia thing kind of got my attention.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a symptom of Roman Catholicism that so many of its priests have abused young boys. It is the essence of Roman Catholicism that its cardinals and popes have protected the image and reputation of the church, while making young boys ever more vulnerable. That isn't, however, my biggest issue with Roman Catholicism. It would be that everything they teach squanders what God had to say in his offering. So in this passage, Paul is putting himself in opposition to Judaism. Well, actually not. He's not putting himself so much in opposition to Judaism, nor is he even saying that he's no longer practicing the Jewish religion, but instead was stating that the Jewish religion was in opposition to God's people. In fact, later in Acts, before a Jewish assembly, Paul will speak of Judaism as if it remained the love of his life. And yet, throughout this letter and in others, his comments are decidedly anti-Semitic, fueling the animosity Christians would harbor against Jews. This duplicity is an enigma, unless perceived from the perspective that Paul wanted to be seen as both in league with and opposition to everyone and everything. It is Paul versus God, the disciples, Yahusha, the Torah, everyone. There is no question that Paul was continued to be religious. It is therefore instructive to know that the Greek word that he used for Judaism is based upon a word which can be defined as the adoption of Jewish customs, traditions, and religious rites, even the observation of ritual law. Therefore, the word that he chose describes rabbinic Judaism, which is the religion in which he was schooled. Being a fundamentalist practitioner of Judaism made Paul opposed to the idea of a redeeming Messiah, to a suffering servant, as opposed to a conquering warrior. But that still does not explain his unbridled animosity towards those who quietly elected to follow Yahusha. Judaism, unlike Islam, indeed, even unlike Christianity, has never inspired rage. From the religion's fledgling beginning circa 200 BCE to the present day, Jews have fought six defensive campaigns, the first three of which failed, all hoping to liberate their homeland from invaders, the Greeks once, the Romans twice, and more recently on three occasions against the Muslims. The religion isn't sufficiently aggressive or violent to inspire the kind of rage that Paul expressed. Nor is there any evidence to suggest that Paul was anything more than a lone wolf, singularly vicious and out of control. Now, this is the second time that Paul has revealed that his cravings were insatiable. First, it was libertine lust, sexual perversions, which he blamed on the Torah. You'll find that admission in Romans 7. Now he is attributing his unrestrained annihilation of passive and peaceful people on his religion. And yet, lost in his arrogance, he wants us to believe that he alone was selected by God to slander him and to undermine his Torah. But I know someone similarly perverted and violent, Muhammad. His bloodlust and appetite for sexual abuse were hallmarks of his life, where terrorism was used to supply an endless stream of booty and babes. His religion grew out of his lusts. Paul may have been very similar. As we consider Paul's claim, I'd be surprised if more than a handful of people, most of whom would have been relatives of his victims, would have even heard of him. I suspect that Paul was a legend in his own mind. And the evidence indicates that Judaism wasn't responsible for his actions. There is no historical evidence to suggest that others were operating similarly. There's no mention of Paul in the rabbinic records. There's no record of such orders in any rabbinic archive. You'd be hard-pressed to find any group more committed to documenting their aims and their arguments than rabbis. And yet there's no mention of this campaign, no mention of this man. Paul was a legend in his own mind. That may be one of the many reasons that Paul provided no specificity with regard to time and place. And if you're wondering why he would admit these awful things, especially if they were exaggerated, it is because he thought that the comparison between the old Shaul and the new Paulos would serve to demonstrate the relative merits of the old system compared to his New Testament. He's very much like Muhammad once again.